So hi, my name is Dave Maynard. I'm here with the original man in blue, Mr. Johnny Cash, called so because of his blue hair. And apparently this morning we've been dubbed the fantastically fabulous hacking duo or something like that. So we're pretty happy about that. We were going to get matching costumes and stuff, but that seemed a bit odd. So we're going to start off with a little bit of an introduction about why we're here and stuff like that. So we're going to be talking about device drivers, specifically Wi-Fi device drivers. You know, the subtitle of our presentation is "Don't Build a House on a Shaky Foundation."
Can we share a mic, or is this going to work?
No, this is showing.
Okay.
We've never been accused of that before. So, just to level set some people's expectations and things like that, I've heard lots of rumors about this presentation. We won't be killing anybody live on stage. I'm sorry. Also, I didn't quit my job to give this presentation. I also won't be talking about voice over IP. So basically, the subtitle of our talk is "Don't Build a House on a Shaky Foundation." And one of the things that we've been finding a lot lately is that OS vendors, as much as a lot of people hate to admit it, OS vendors like Microsoft, Apple, Linux distributions and things like that have been hardening their operating systems a lot. So attackers have two choices pretty much. They can either go up to the application layer and do things like file inclusion or SQL injection attacks, or they can go low, basically down into device driver level. And, I'm sure a lot of people have had experiences where they'll plug in a new device or install a device driver and something weird happens and they get a lot of blue screens. That's generally because the code quality from a security standpoint of device drivers just generally isn't all that good. So, this is that was the overview of the problem. Some of the things we're going to be talking about is basically the gist of this entire thing. I'm sure a lot of people are here to see this is breaking into a laptop remotely over Wi-Fi. And one of the questions that we got a lot was, if you have a vulnerability that targets a specific device driver, on a specific type of platform or something like that, how useful is that? Because you can't really remotely tell, what chipset and things like that you're running. Strangely enough, we can. Mr. Johnny Cash's work will show how we can fingerprint device drivers remotely down to, the chipset, the version, and even down to the version of the driver, which would make, an attack more accurate. We're going to be talking a little bit about finding and exploiting vulnerabilities, shellcode design, and of course, in all exclamation points, the demos, which, should be pretty interesting. So, speed to market is so important. A lot of hardware manufacturers, they have to ship things quickly. I mean, like the 802.11n stuff you're seeing now and WiMAX are pretty good examples of that. People are getting pushed to get stuff out the door as quickly as possible. And one of the things that, often gets sacrificed in, the speed game is security. As long as it works and people can use it, that's all that matters to a lot of people when they ship stuff. So, that means that a lot of things just don't get tested properly. And one of the reasons that we're talking about this topic is we're hoping to improve vendor awareness about a lot of these problems before, you're having Wi-Fi drivers or Wi-Fi devices and things like that that are giving you much longer ranges. Because right now an attack, you have to be in local proximity, which is, the range of something like 802.11b, which is going to be a couple hundred feet at most. But, as the ranges and things like that, increase, these problems aren't fixed, this could be, a serious problem if you have access to somebody's machine 10 miles away. So, new hardware and committee design protocols. Mr. Mike Lynn used to always say that committee design protocols were very, very bad. So they're especially susceptible to things like this. One of the things that happens a lot during, the committee design phase of a new protocol and things like that, people just don't really ask the questions. The questions are more geared towards how do things work and not how could things go bad. So, that's one of the things that, we'd like to see people ask more. So, although what, we're going to be talking about is mostly focused on 802.11a, b, and g, we were hoping to have some 802.11n stuff for this, but we didn't quite make it in time. But, the methodology and the thought process and things like that can apply to Bluetooth, new 802.11 specs and, wireless data things like Edge, EVDO, and HSDPA. So have device drivers been a problem in the past? These are three examples of device drivers, two of them, of course, in Windows. One of them is in FreeBSD. But device drivers have been exploited in the past. What's funny is we're not talking about something that, a lot of people don't know about. It's just that a lot of people don't know about the severity of the issue. I mean, examples that are on the screen are things like the Symantec firewall DNS overflow from a couple of years ago. That was in the device driver. You have the TCP/IP vulnerability, you know, that was discovered by ISS, Neomeda. It was an IP options off by one bug. It was in TCP/IP.sys. You have the server service vulnerability that was just recently released, and even a FreeBSD Wi-Fi integer overflow that was, you know, fixed and patched a couple of months ago. So, you know, there is a pretty dedicated history so far of, you know, people being able to remotely exploit device drivers. And one thing people don't think about are that these device drivers generally do parse a lot of untrusted code. A lot of resistance I've encountered from people about the easeability and the actual feasibility of exploiting these things are, well, you're in kernel space, or, you know, you're at a high privilege level. So if you do something bad, like, you know, dereference a null pointer or, you know, something like that, you blue screen the box. And, you know, that's pretty much true, but you've got to keep in mind that people with unlimited amount of time and, like, you know, Firefly episodes on DVD can spend a lot of time looking at these things. So, and I mean, that's pretty much what we've had to do, but, you know, personally, I'm a Battlestar Galactica fan, so I spend time with that in Hot Pockets, of course. And, of course, you know, this is the thing that I've gotten most questions about, is if I had something to do with these Intel patches that came out this weekend. And I like to categorically at this time say no, we didn't. Although we do think it's pretty interesting that, you know, the timing of it. I mean, they were released on Sunday, almost like they were released right before a certain talk or something like that. I don't know. But it seemed like a bit suspicious. But, you know, one of the things I have to do is, I haven't had a chance to look at any of these patches or evaluate them or reverse engineer and find out what the vulnerabilities were. But, you know, you have to admire a company that would proactively fix things before a talk instead of waiting until afterwards. So that's pretty cool. So,
let's see. You mute yours?
I'm going to mute mine now.
Okay, so hopefully this works out. All right, I'm going to end up holding my mic tight and typing, so this might not go so well. Let's try it, though. So Dave's been talking about device drivers in general, and he's the really smart Ring Zero ninja guy between us, and I'm more of the 802.11 standards all day kind of guy. So I don't really do that much kernel coding, so I'm going to talk about the protocol and some of the inherent complexities of it, which turns out to be the real big problem that we're exploiting. So 802.11, why is it so complicated, and does it have to be, and can we fix it? And the consequences of it being so complicated are that you can fingerprint it and you can exploit it. So we'll get to those. So why is it so complicated? I think my friend Warlord, and I think it was Warlord, my other Silk friends might disagree, but said fear leads to anger leads to hate, and hate leads to protocols designed by committee. Maybe it's protocols designed by committee lead to hate. I'm not sure, but you know, it's too big, and I'll show you why it's too big in a minute, but nobody could conceivably implement this entire standard correctly in, like, less than a year, in my opinion. So why is 802.11 so complicated? Well, partly because it's too ambitious, partly because it really has to deal with more, you know, it really is a more complex problem than Ethernet, and some of the, you know, the complexity comes from the fact that there's hidden nodes, there's consistently unreliable links, and there's other networks on the same channel, you know. Simple Ethernet device drivers, and you know, that's what we're usually dealing with, don't have to deal with anything like that. So what could you do to fix it? Well, I'm like a standards Nazi. My friends would probably agree that I think you should implement the standard like as much as you can, but for 802.11, I think that you should be able to get some sort of certification for something like 802.11-. 802.11 that works mostly, but ignores a lot of stuff that shouldn't be there. So what could you ignore? Well, most management frames, I think. I think a number of DOS and disassociate packets sent in the role that are sent by illegitimate hackers versus your access point kicking you off your network is probably a pretty bad ratio right now. There's nothing you can do about it. Similarly for some control frames and some extra features which are coming up. So like I said, the whole reason we're interested in all this complexity is because complexity is the hacker's best friend. If it's not complex, then people can't do it incorrectly. And we need somebody to do it wrong so we can get code execution. So I'm going to compare 802.11 to Ethernet because everybody I think in the room is probably familiar with Ethernet. If I gave out, you know, 614 bytes and said this is an Ethernet header, a lot of people could figure out what it said. So Ethernet has, you know, three fields, source, destination, and type. 802.11 has a version, a type, a subtype, 8 flags, 1, 2, 3, or 4 addresses in variable positions, a fragment number, a secret number, and then you're through the normal header. After that, you've got a whole bunch of extra packets to keep track of. 11 management frames, 6 control frames, lots of subtypes, and various encryption fields. And so that is just so much more complex than an Ethernet device driver, which is what most people think of when they think network device driver. And okay, if typical fields in the header aside, what else does it have? Well, it's got ad hoc mode. So how many people here have actually used an ad hoc network to do something productive? Okay. Yeah, so that's why we should cut it out of the standard, or at least make it optional. Power savings. Now, power savings is good, and it probably actually does help with battery life a lot in certain embedded cases. And I don't think, you know, I think that is probably overhead worth keeping. But it imposes a significant amount of overhead on the access point. And so if I was going to start fuzzing access points, which I haven't done yet, I would probably start messing around there. It's got two types of media access control, PCF versus DCF. Most people don't even know it, but the 802.11 standard is littered with words that nobody cares about PCF, which is basically wireless token ring, more or less. You can imagine how many vendors jump to implement that. I mean, token ring is awesome, right? It's a simplification, but I mean, how many people are going to implement that? No one did, but it's still in there, so you got to at least skip through it. 11E, quality of service. I think this one made it, you know, it's going to come be part of the standard pretty soon. I'm not sure how much this is going to help. So how many people are trying to do video conferencing on a wireless network that doesn't hit a wired network where there's no quality of service? Like, so you're all on the same access point trying to hold a video conference, then quality of service helps out a lot, right? But you're within a couple hundred feet of each other. I mean, the Ethernet side doesn't give a damn about your quality of service packets. Those fields get stripped. Nobody cares upstream, so I don't see how much of an improvement that could make. And just to show you like the sort of attitude they have, if somebody at one of the 802.11 committee meetings told me that geolocating was proposed, which means like the access point has some sense of its location, and so do you. So you either try to tell the access point where you are, it's trying to tell you where you are, like with GPS coordinates or some other coordinate system. What the hell does that have to do with media access control? Like, that is not a layer 2 standard kind of thing to throw in there. I mean, that's not going to go in, but people are proposing that, I hear. It's crazy. So if you were to remove all these extras and come to what I've called 802.11 minus minus, what would you end up with? Well, a Nintendo DS, actually. It's not at all certified for anything. It's no Wi-Fi certs, nowhere near 802.11 compliant, ignores DOS and disassociates. I think it ignores most control packets. Works great. You know why? You know how I figured this out? I ran my fuzzer against it. Nothing happened.
We're not sponsored by Nintendo, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this is just the only example I've seen in the real world of somebody who took the 802.11 standard and said, you know, chop it in half, and we got something that works. And I couldn't get this thing to do anything except do what it was supposed to. And it probably doesn't roam very well. Again, how many people want their Nintendo DS to roam between access points, right? When you're flying down the highway or something, playing your video games. So that is why 802.11 is so unnecessarily complicated, in my opinion. Is there anybody in here from the IEEE? Because I'm probably going to get lynched afterward. My thesis advisor disagrees strongly, by the way. So fingerprinting 802.11, why bother? Well, the obvious one is so we've got if you happen to have a pocket full of wireless OD and you want to know who to hit what with, then you'd like to know what sort of device driver they've got. There's other legitimate uses too. Wireless IDS vendors could monitor users' chipset and driver. And you could potentially use this to refine operating system fingerprints if that was your real goal. Basically, the wireless IDS case is a company issues you a laptop and they say, you can connect to our network, but you can only use this piece of hardware, but they can't authenticate the hardware. It's just a laptop. It's not doing anything special with hardware authentication. It doesn't have certificates. If you hopped on the network with your own home laptop and signed on, and you had a significantly different driver, they could potentially tell and flag it or something. But of course, it could be circumvented. Just get the right chipset driver and you're good to go. But, you know, it's got some defensive uses. So why is this cool? Well, I think it's cool because I don't know of any linked layer protocol fingerprints that, you know, I've never seen anybody fingerprint an Ethernet device driver. I mean, it's probably possible in other less commercially available wireless protocols because they're, you know, complicated too. But you can't walk in the Best Buy and buy a $30 card that lets you inject packets into these obscure networks. You can with these. And ultimately, it's possible because of the complexity of the protocol. So one question I had when I started on this was, how far down can you go? Well, chipset would be a good start, and that's originally where we thought we might end. But it turns out that you can not only get the chipset, but distinct drivers for the same chipset, and then different versions of the same driver, which was exactly what you want if you're going to do an exploit, because you could set your return address ahead of time, and if there's any different quirks, you know about them. We never really tried the fingerprint firmware. I imagine you could, but it just didn't catch our interest because so many cards are coming with so much stuff stripped out and put in the software. So we've got three specific fingerprints I'm going to talk to, depending on how much time we have. The first one is RTS, CTS window honoring, and then association redirection, and finally duration analysis, which is the cool one. So RTS CTS means request to send and clear to send for people who don't spend their days looking at 802.11 specs. So RTS CTS packets are used to reserve the media if it's worth doing, because there's some overhead in sending them. You don't want to do this for every packet. You're like, hey, I'm going to send something. Here it is. I'm going to send, you know, it doesn't make sense unless it's a big packet to send. So here's the scenario that's trying to avoid. A sends a large frame, and B can't see it because he's off in the distance, and they can only hear the access point. So A sends a big frame. Halfway through, B transmits. There's a collision at the access point, you know, and he can't tell who said what. So then, you know, the A has to retransmit the whole packet. So in this scenario, A sends a request to send. It's basically saying, I need the error for, you know, however many microseconds. Then B, or the access point, retransmits the clear to send, says A needs the error for, you know, 20,000 microseconds. Everyone shut up. And then B can hear that. And, you know, then B stays quiet and then sends a frame and everything's good. So the question was, how many implementations use this? Because you could sort of at least determine, okay, if some implementations use this and some don't, then you've got at least a bit of information. It's this big set or this big set. But most implementations... No, few, no, none, yeah. So that's not to say that you couldn't convince these drivers to do that. I've seen some where you go set a flag and it'll start doing it for this size, and, you know, that sort of helps. But we were interested, of course, in, you know, default states of drivers, because you don't want to start fingerprinting strange ones. So that didn't work. But that, it's just because they don't use RTS packets. It doesn't mean they're free to ignore other people's CTS packets. So the idea was, well, some of these people are hopefully going to honor these CTS packets and not transmit on other people's time, and some won't. And, you know, that was the motivation for trying to fingerprint this. And it turns out, as far as I could tell, everybody just ignores the CTS packets, period. And that doesn't make for a very good fingerprint. On the other hand, as soon as somebody does, they'll stand out really well. But, I mean, it's also equally likely that my code was buggy and didn't work, but I've talked to enough people that they all say, yeah, it doesn't seem like anybody honors these. And there are definitely cases I track down by hand where I could clearly tell it wasn't. So, and strangely enough, those are mostly beacons, I think, because they're time sensitive. But a big problem with this is you need a microsecond resolution clock attached to every packet so you can see who transmitted over what. And you can get those in Prism headers, if you know what those are, or some other proprietary headers. And still, it depends on, like, was this timestamp attached at, like, the interrupt when the packet got sent? Or was it attached later by the kernel? And it gets pretty difficult to have that high resolution. I got close enough, but it might be difficult to refine. So that was RTS, CTS. Didn't turn out. About 2 weeks of my life, I was pretty bummed. So association redirection. This one works. It's an active technique, which makes it less cool, but and it has chipset level resolution. And when we first got that, you know, that was pretty good. It's mind-numbingly boring to automate, and I know this because I didn't automate it, and I had to do it by hand. And it basically came down to staring at Ethereal, which a lot of, like, really fancy color filters labeled, so I could go red, red, blue, green, blue. Okay, that's this. And it was a pain. So before I can explain it, I've got to just explain three quick fields in 802.11. So for those of you who don't know, every 802.11 packet, or at least data packet, which we're talking about now, has three addresses in it. It's got the source, a destination, and a BSS ID. And, you know, the source and destination are what you would assume, but the BSS ID is the address of the access point it's going to. So you can see, I can't point, but you can see in the BSS ID field on this slide that it's the address of the access point, so no surprises. You know, In a normal 802.11 association, you exchange four different frames. There's an authentication request, an authentication reply, an association request, an association reply, and then data. And all the addresses in this are what you think. You know, the destination is the access point, the BSS ID is the access point, the source is the guy connecting, and flipping around, you know, it's intuitive enough. Association redirection is what happens when the access point changes addresses during this association phase. Now, this is motivated in the standard, which I'll get to later. But for now, if you change a source address on an association reply, the idea was that the clients would actually start connecting to that address. It was as if you had redirected them, in this case, to 00222222. And I was actually trying to do that to get them to redirect, not because I wanted to fingerprint them previously. And it doesn't really work to redirect people. A few cards and a few corner cases do it somewhat, and that's not what we're too interested in anyway. What it turns out is the cards all do fairly unique things. The ones in pink here are Theros cards. They just ignore the association reply, which is a pretty logical thing to do, and the source address isn't what you expected, so, you know, dump it. Some other ones do some very strange things. Broadcom chipsets seem to send a DOT flood to the null BSS ID. No idea. Like, I can't imagine a human sitting down and going, in this case, when they change the source address on me, I'm going to do this. Like, what motivation would you have? I cannot find anything in the standard which leads me to believe that that is something near correct, but that's what they do. Another card, the Prism card, will deauth the access point, which at least makes more sense because he's involved. A null BSS ID doesn't really mean much to anyone. And the Intel Pro Wireless Centrino cards, they actually sort of redirect. They think they're on two networks, so they keep transmitting on two different BSS IDs, which is a very strange thing to see. But the point is not exactly what everybody does, but they all do something different, so you could categorize them and throw them in their own thing and figure out what chipset people got. So, like I said, cards got null addresses. They think they're on both networks, and then there's some less dramatic hijinks. So, this is just an example of the Broadcom DOF flood things. Oh, so we got an Apple card here. He's trying to authenticate to the network, the sources of the network. This is the authentication reply. Sorry, so we don't see the request. This is the reply going back off the network, the BSS source ID here. 00112233445. So that's the original network he wants to connect to. Okay, association request goes back, looks normal. And then the access point mangles the source address in the association reply right here to 0022, and the DOS flood to the null BSS ID starts. So that's just one example of the weird things these cards do. Now, if you could, I spelled DOS wrong, that's great. I think PowerPoint messed my fonts up. Anyway, so that's what a DOS flood looks like. So it's just an example of the weird things these do. Now, if you wrote a script to classify this, that would be great. I had to do it all by hand, and I can't imagine trying to make this go any smoother. So if one standard's quirk is good, three must be better. Instead of just mangling the source, let's figure out what other things we can mangle to get these cards to behave differently. So we mangle the source, we mangle the BSS ID, and then we mangle both. So now I got to get the table too, which means I got right here. Should have opened these ahead of time, huh? Sorry. So this is table 2. Make it bigger for you. So each column in here represents what happens when you mangle the source, the BSS ID, and both of them, only in the association reply. So you leave the authentication reply alone, and you get this pretty table. And you can see the chipsets stick together. Like, these top four are all Theros. They almost all look the same. These three are exactly the same driver, so they all look identical. This one's mildly different. And orange, pink, orange ones, they're all Broadcom chips. So the chipsets really stick together. And similarly to the case where you're mangling just the source or mangling association reply packets, you could all your Mingle authentication packets. So this gives you a whole another three columns and another table. And a lot of this case in the cards, they seem to be more paranoid on authentication packets, so they just ignore them, which is a sensible thing to do. Way more sensible than sending a broadcast DAuth to no one. So most of these cards just ignore the packets. This guy doesn't. These blue ones sort of redirect. But they all, you know, the chipsets clump together, which is what you want. And finally, you can mingle the addresses in both cases, resulting in another table. And a lot of packet captures for me to sit down and look through. That was a blast. So basically, all I can tell from these tables is the chipset. You don't really get any sort of driver-level resolution except in this one case where this Atheros driver stands out from this Atheros driver. So, you know, it's cool that you can get chipset-level resolution, but we're going to do better than that. So, yeah. So, association redirection, you can remotely version chipsets, but you need to set up an access point to help you do it, and you gotta get someone to connect, so that's not nearly as cool as doing it entirely passively. And the whole reason we set out doing these weird things to these frames is because if you look at this, the 1999 revision in page 376, you'll find the straight state transition diagram, which says, don't do that. It says, set my BSS ID equal to the address to your association. And PowerPoint is unhappy. Ooh. That's weird. Doesn't want to skip. Okay, so that was association redirection. Now I'm going to talk about the one that I'm going to actually demo here. It's a duration analysis. This one is totally passive. It's very accurate. It's easy to automate. I've already done it mostly. And it only uses some basic statistical techniques. So what's a duration? A duration is a 16-bit field in most 802.11 packets, which says, how long do I need the error after this packet? So it's not how long it takes to see this packet, because we've already got it by the time you see this number. It's, I've got the error, I'm sending a packet to my friend, maybe I'm sending it to my friend Dave, I need Dave to acknowledge it, because 802.11's got positive acknowledgement. So I don't want him to, like, okay, I sent my packet, then the whole protocol kicks in for the random back off, and oh, Dave's got to wait to acknowledge. You don't want to have to do that. So it just says, I've got the error, sending this packet, and after I send this packet, I need the error a little bit longer, mostly for acknowledgement. So it's only a 16-bit field, so you think it would have a lot of range, but in reality, there's only a few legitimate values to be placing in there, you know, time it takes to acknowledge, stuff, you know, zero if you don't need to acknowledge it. So it's not like you've got a huge variation of numbers there. In fact, it's only between 12 and 20 in some databases. So if you're going to do a fingerprint based off this, there's a couple of things that influence it. One is the rate of the access point. Clearly, if you can transmit packets faster, then the numbers for duration are going to be smaller. And over time, 802.11 has picked up a couple of optimizations, short slot time and a short preamble. And if you wanted to have a perfect fingerprint, you would take every 802.11 implementation, vary every one of these fields, so run it against the speed, short slot time, no short slot time, short preamble. But in reality, some of these don't make sense. You would rarely see an 11G network running with no optimizations. So I have four databases built, which seems to be working pretty well. I'll probably make some more. Okay, so now I'm going to show you guys what's in a sample fingerprint file. So this example comes from an Atheros card, and in my opinion, Atheros cards are well behaved because they don't do anything crazy. And you just see here the 314 value next to association request is just duration value 314 shows up 100% of the time in association requests. And the probe requests, it's 0.97% of the time, and 314, 3% of the time. And that's a kind of strange thing. Why would the values change 3% of the time? I have no idea, but it kind of makes the card stick out. And similarly for authentication in data and other fields. And the other probabilities it computes is the probability of seeing a duration regardless of the packet type. So down at the bottom, see a 0 with 19%. That means duration value 0 is used 19% of the time regardless of the packet. And so those probabilities at the bottom are actually going to be dominated by the value used in most data packets because the vast majority of data sent is data packets. But they come into play later. So here's an example of Prism fingerprint. It's poorly behaved. So the biggest difference here is that the authentication packet you see there has a value of 53389 100% of the time. Now, it's a lot of microseconds for something that doesn't get acknowledged, or maybe it does, but anyway, that's a very long time. In fact, it's so long that it's illegal. Any number larger than 32767, it's the standard says to just ignore. So Prism cards put two illegal values in here, you know, one in authentication, one in null function. So they stand out really easily. They do some other weird things too, but don't have time to get into it. And you can see that they use more data. There's three distinct data points in here for the data packet. And on Theros, there's only two. So not only did they use different ones, but they use more. And so I want to give you guys a real demo in a second, but this is just so I don't have to jump out of PowerPoint all the time. If you were to run a program to try to take an input PCAP, one came from a Theros card, and the PCAP comes from a Theros card on the left. Say, okay, it's an input PCAP. I'm only going to give you two fingerprints to compare to, an Theros card or a Prism card. And you can see right here that if I just gave two people in the room, or a person, these two fingerprints in a packet capture, they could go, oh, this is a Prism card because it's got this awkward duration value. So it's no magic here that this program can tell between a Prism and a Theros. It gets trickier when you throw in 14 or 15 cards, all who are much more similar. So the score here for the left-hand column is that it says, okay, it's an Theros card, I think, 51.4, and if it's not, then I guess it's a Prism. Those numbers aren't actually probabilities, they're just scores. You can't interpret them as probability. It's just ordered. And similarly, on the right-hand column, it's, okay, got a Prism PCAP. I only got these two fingerprints to compare it to. What do you think it is? Oh, stands out like a Prism card, you know, much more distinctly because it's got all those crazy unique values. So a realistic example is here. You say, okay, got a PCAP file. The MAC address I'm interested in is 00AA95, etc. And I want to know what kind of card it is. And so now it's comparing it against my entire database of 14. And it's probably hard to read. But the first row right here says Broadcom Mini PCI. It's not a Broadcom Mini PCI. This is actually my PowerBook. And right underneath it is Apple Airport Extreme. So it was wrong in a sense, right? The wrong chipset is on top, or the wrong driver is on top. But the scores are very close here. The score for the Broadcom Mini PCI is 79, and score for the Airport Extreme is 78. So it had a hard time telling them apart. But the interesting thing is all the chipsets on top are Broadcom. And then the rest of them seem to clump together too. Further down below, the arrows are all next to each other. So you can see that it's really picking up how these chipsets are related. And so, all right, I'm going to try to type and talk, so hopefully my mic doesn't get too annoyed at me. I think it will, though. Right. Okay, so this is just the example I just showed in the PowerPoint where I'm trying to fingerprint the Apple Airport card. So you can see the program actually run and not just a bunch of PowerPoint slides. So a more interesting example would be, let's say you want to know if somebody's got a vulnerable, this isn't going to work so well, a vulnerable Centrino driver or the new one, and I quick downloaded their 130 meg zip file to patch my driver. I think operating systems are smaller than that in some cases. So I looked and looked. I thought, surely this is extra junk and I can just find the driver. It's 130 megs. So I got their new driver and I attempted to fingerprint it, and I can actually distinguish it from the older one. So I'm going to have to just mute my mic for a second. Otherwise, you guys need an ear full of feedback and type something. So hang on.
While he's typing, can I ask a question? How many people here are running wireless sniffers right now? Can you just raise your hand? Nope, nobody? One? Somehow I feel the actual number is much higher than the reflected number in my survey. Just wondering.
Okay, so the command I just awkwardly typed says, I got a PCAP. This is one I took earlier because I didn't know if anybody was going to be messing with my wireless network, and I wanted to make sure this worked, though I will be doing a real demo later. So I got a PCAP. This is from a vulnerable Intel driver, and I'm just going to try to match it against my database. And you can see up on top are two Intel drivers. Sys-vuln9039 is the name I gave the vulnerable driver, and that was a vulnerable PCAP, so that's good. Let's try this, the patched, updated one. And you see the patch one comes out on top. So in between fixing, the remote code execution issues, they've also changed the behavior of the driver, intentionally or not. Maybe there was other, fixes besides security. So you can actually tell these apart, which would be, great if you're trying to actually exploit someone, right? So that's just to show you an example of this. Now, back to the slide. So if you wanted to measure the performance of one of these algorithms, it's a good question as to how would you do it. So measuring it against a single database is pretty easy, right? If you had a bunch of PCAPs, was it right? Was it wrong? Well, that's easy. But if you've actually got a bunch of different databases, because you need more than one, you can't just have, a B1, you want to have a G1, and so on. They might be different size. For example, I've got a G-only database. It's only got 7 cards, I think, because all my B1s can't connect. And so if you just wanted to measure the errors per database, it's not comparable. It's a lot easier to get it right when you only got 7 versus 14. So the way I decided to measure the performance of this tool is just how much better does it do than random on a given database, and that becomes comparable across databases. So in this case, if you assume it random is just going to throw things around, the right card is going to end up somewhere in the middle of the list, and you're going to see a whole bunch of, I should have explained the table first, huh? Okay, so S1, S2, and S3 refer to 3 distinct PCAPs I've taken for a given implementation. And the zeros and the ones in here and the twos represent how far down the correct device driver was found. So for example, that airport that I showed you a minute ago, this one where the airport card is one down in the list, that corresponds to PowerPoint hating me. No, corresponds to the 5 row, because that's the airport card, and the 1 in bold right there. So it was 1 down, it gets a 1. Now the zeros mean it did perfect on all those input PCAPs, and 2 means it was 2 down. And you can see there's an awful lot of zeros here, which means you're doing pretty good. In fact, you can tell exactly how well you're doing. You're doing 30 times better than random, because random would just, it'd end up in the middle roughly, and so you see a bunch of 6s everywhere on average, so you can compute how many times better you're doing. So 30 times better than random is, I think, pretty good. I mean, people didn't think you could do this before. They definitely didn't think you could get past the chipset. It looks like there's a lot of device driver versions in here. And so to point out that the top 4 rows on this are all Atheros cards. The one IDs number 2, 3, and 4 are exactly the same driver. They're different cards with different chipsets, but it's the exact same bit-for-bit driver. So you can tell when you swap out a different card using the same driver, you can tell it's apart most of the time. So how's it work? Do we have time to say how it works? I guess so. Nope. Okay. So how's it work? I'm only going to talk about one algorithm, Simple Compare. Simple Compare treats the fingerprint as 2 sets of duration values. So ignore the packet type here and you take the intersection of these sets. For every 2 points that are in the intersection, you return 1 minus, and then some math. You take the number of packets with the same duration divided by the number of packets. So that's just the probability of seeing that duration on the card on the left minus the probability of seeing that duration of the card on the right. And the idea here is if these 2 cards use the same duration value but in totally different scenarios, one uses it all the time, one uses it, almost another time, this is actually going to be close to 0. It's going to be 1 minus a lot. But if they're using the duration in roughly the same proportion, then it's going to be close to 1. So the higher the score, the better it does. And if you just do this, if you just look at durations and you ignore packet types, you get to do 10 times better than average, which is good. You'll at least get chipset level resolution. If you then simple compare says, okay, we're going to take the packet type and the durations into concern, and then we compute the probability of seeing the same packet type duration. So you take the packet types into account, you do 21 times better than random. Now, that's a lot better. And if you actually were to combine these, which is what simple compare does, you get 23 times better than random on average across a lot of samples across four databases. You can see, some of these do better than others. There's a 46.8 in Lexi and in some other algorithms that gets even higher. But on average, across a lot of databases, 23. So that's pretty good. So before we go do the video, I'm just going to show you a quick live demo of the fingerprinting stuff. Okay, so all those zeros on the screen mean I'm trying to match it against this laptop right here, and it doesn't have any packets for it because this card is off. So you can know that this is actually happening in real time. The packets are being captured with KISMAC. Gonna hope this all works out, huh? Turn on my wireless card. Okay, good. It's connecting to the access point. I hope that works. Okay, so at this point, the laptop has connected, but I haven't loaded any web pages. I've transferred virtually no data packets, just PHCP, I guess. And the correct card is a Broadcom mini PCI card. It's built in, and it's three down in this list. So I'm going to go over here, load some web pages, click reload a few times, watch it jump to the top of the list. So, get enough data, it gets it right, and keep doing it, score gets a little higher. So, there you go, real-time demo of fingerprinting. If we have time later, we'll do some people in the audience. Thank you. Okay.
We're running a little short on time, so it's going to be pretty quick. So finding exploits in device drivers. Finding exploits in device drivers is really what inspired this. And I gotta be honest, Mr. Johnny Cash over here is one of the people who initially introduced me to this because for the last year or so, I've been looking at different kinds of device driver problems. And one of the things I really always wanted to look at was Wi-Fi stuff, but there were some problems with that, like how to do certain raw packet injection and things like that, modifications to code. So John is actually one of the people who got me initially started on that. So ways to find bugs, this is all your standard stuff. You got your static auditing, that's your binary analysis. You bust out your Halvar plate skills and things like that. For open source stuff or, things that come with it, source code analysis. One of the things that I found is a lot of people will reverse engineer binary drivers, then re-implement the way that they work in open source. So if you're kind of confused on how something's working, taking a look at the way the open source driver is doing it, for instance, like one of the Broadcom chips is pretty useful. And of course, one of the ways that we found a lot of this stuff was fuzzing. We'll fuzz your built-in wireless cards, your third-party cards. We haven't done this much yet, but we want to go to the embedded devices and access points. John has had some success with making access points just not work anymore. Of course, that's not that useful, but it's pretty cool. So fuzzing can be frustrating. And if you ever had to hunt down a bug in ring zero or, basically in your kernel space, you can know that, man, that's not all that easy. I mean, it can be triggered by something, eight packets ago, and it's, taking the timer or the timeout or something, then causing a crash or something like that. And, you know, for a lot of things, you know, auditing or debugging in Ring Zero isn't all that easy. Although, if you want to know more, I recommend the Barnaby Jack paper on stepping into Ring Zero for the exploitation stuff. So this is actually John's slide. So.
Okay, Fuzzy in like a minute. So Fuzzy is my very uncreatively named 802.11 fuzzer. I still have your name, my fingerprinter, by the way. So this is Fuzzy. Fuzzy has three interfaces. It's got an Ethernet interface, a fuzzing traffic interface to reject packets, and a monitoring interface. In this case, ATHO is monitoring. Fuzzing is on an RA link card. Basically, this isn't the kind of fuzzer that you run and like, bam, you get a crash. Fuzzy isn't very smart. It makes up for its lack of smarts in time. It's sort of like brute forcing the 802.11 packet space in some sense. So Fuzzy is just gonna create a packet with enough of a header that it looks like it knows where it's going, and it's just random junk. Like, doesn't make any attempt to try to make the type or subtype really look like a real subtype. Doesn't put any payloads in. There's just junk that looks like it knows where it's going. So it sends out all these packets. But first, before it sends the packets out, it pings the wired side of the computer it's attacking. Is it up? Great. Let's throw some junk 802.11 packets at it. Da-da-da. Okay, is it, no. Is it still up? Oh, damn, still up. Okay, well, I'm going to move on to the next guy, because that guy's got to recover. Because actually, the name of this game is getting as many packets out in the smallest amount of time as you can. And if you just fuzz the driver for like a minute, it takes it like 30 seconds to get back up to like, okay, I can transmit data again. So while it's getting up, it moves on to the next guy. And the next guy, okay, ping it. It's up. Send some packets. Is it still up? No. Great. Log everything I just captured off ATHO to a PCAP file and, you know, put an entry in a log file and keep doing this all night. So wake up in the morning, and if you're lucky, all your laptops have crashed and you've got the, you know, Microsoft, this Windows system has incurred, you know, seen a serious error. Would you like to send it off? Not so much. And there you go. That's how Fuzzy works. Not very smart. Gets the job done.
And here's basically a screen detailing, you know, the command line options. It's pretty cool. So I wrote a fuzzer that works a little bit differently. And my fuzzer's a little bit, say again? Yeah, it's a little bit smarter. So basically what I do is reverse engineer drive a little bit to understand the differences between the implementations and then implement the fuzzer based on that. Everything's basically, you write pseudo rules, kind of like snort, and it allows you to add new packet types relatively quickly to exercise, you know, kind of the kind of code path you're trying to hit. So shellcode, most, you know, one of the things to keep in mind about these types of attacks is normally, if you're going to exploit something and you get it good, you really can't get a connect back shell back to you. So you have the ability to attack machines that aren't on your same network, that aren't associated with the same access point as you are. So you don't really have that great way to do, you know, bidirectional TCP communication. So, you know, for most of these attacks, return shell just really is not that feasible. So these are really great for more like dropping a bot on a machine or, you know, something that when a, you know, interface comes back up, it will communicate with you. But, you know, you're not trying to get a return shell initially. So we're going to run a video now that's going to show an interesting demo. We're running the video because we couldn't come up with a good way to break in, to attack one laptop from another one without all you great people running sniffers getting copies of it. So we might have a slight problem with the sound, so I might have to narrate, and I have to tell you, I like kung fu movies. Device drivers. Don't Build a House on a Shaky Foundation by Johnny Cash and David Maynard. Well, apparently it's not working. So right now I'm babbling about something I'm pretty sure.
Something that we wish we could be doing live in Vegas, but due to security reasons, we can't really. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be using this machine as an attacker, and I'm going to be bringing in another machine.
Bam.
That we'll be using as the victim. And don't think, however, just because we're attacking an Apple, the flaw itself is in an Apple. We're actually using a third-party wireless card.
It's being obscured.
So normally for this attack to work, you do not have to have the victim associated to an access point or authenticate in any way. But for the ease of this demo, This machine will, this Dell will be acting as a wireless access point with the address of 192.168.1.1. And this machine will have a address of 192.168.1.50. The attack will be launched from here. It will affect, it will manipulate buggy code and device driver on this Apple. This Apple will connect back to the attacker with the shell, at which time I'll have complete interactive access.
Don't I look constipated?
So the first point, the part is turning this laptop into an access point. I do that with a script I wrote called setup.
Making me a script kitty.
We'll actually create a an access point called SW Apple Demo. And we'll make this a wireless access point, and then we'll connect the Apple to it. So let's run that script.
No actual Apple icons were harmed in filming this video.
We have an IP address of 192.168.1.50. Now what we do is we run the exploit.
I have sexy fingers. I need to. Look how fat I am.
There are no wires attached to devices. I just create a file on desktop called iwalkedaround.txt.
Showing on.
Yep.
And I just deleted it. The thing to keep in mind here is although we attacked an Apple, the flaw is not specifically in the Apple operating system as we use third-party hardware. This type of a flaw will be systemic across all operating systems and hardware, and the only way to prevent it is proper testing. Although this flaw is and can lead to a remotely exploitable condition, it's not as trivial as a generic buffer overflow. On behalf of Johnny Cash, myself, David Maynard, and the Skidworks research team, thank you for watching.
Seriously, didn't it look like I was a deer caught in headlights or something? So there's something I really want to point out. I own a Mac. In fact, the black Mac Book Pro we were using was my actual MacBook. So we don't dislike Mac, and we're not trying to pick on Mac, or we're not trying to bash Mac. I'm actually a big fan of Mac. But we wanted to do some other demos, and you know they weren't panning out. So we thought, you know, what could we go for that a lot of people wouldn't think that you could actually be able to break into? And you know, I gotta be honest, those Mac commercials, they jump right out at you. So we're not specifically targeting Mac. The thing to keep in mind is these kind of vulnerabilities are systemic across basically operating systems and hardware. I mean, and the purpose of a talk like this is to highlight that, yes, this is a problem, and vendors should be dealing with it now before it's a big problem in a year or two. So with that being said, do we have any questions? Do we have anyone sad they didn't get a copy of the exploit? Yes, sir. Well, what's funny is it's a very high crash to exploitable ratio. I mean, there's lots of conditions in a wireless stack that you can lead to a blue screen, but that's not going to be able to lead to an exploitable condition. Things just like, you know, you declaring that a certain amount of data will follow this, and it doesn't follow, you know, stuff like that. So there's actually a lot more DOSes than exploitable conditions, but I didn't think that showcasing a DOS on stage would have the same kind of punch. Yes, sir, in the back. The video is going to be posted on Brian Krebs' blog at washingtonpost.com/securityfix. So you'll be able to download it and scrutinize it until your heart's content. Or you can make fan pictures of me. I'm partial to that myself. Any other questions? Yes, sir, in the back. I'm sorry, I can barely hear you. Yes, that's one of the things I forgot to mention. We've contacted Apple, and actually, I've heard horror stories about people reporting things to Apple, but strangely, after seeing this video, they were quite responsive. So I'm actually working with them now to get enough of details for them to fix the problems and things like that. And after, we'll follow a responsible disclosure policy, and after a patch has been released, I'm happy to make details available. But, not like exploit code or anything, just, enough to verify. Mr. Lin. No gorilla suit this time. Any other questions? Can you patch it? There's no patch currently available. So, no. Any other questions? All right, well, on behalf of myself, David Maynor, and Johnny Cash, I'd like to thank you for coming to our presentation.